This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Purdue University Northwest, like other universities across the state and the nation, are doing the best they can to distribute federal funds they receive to students coming in because of the financial challenges that students face due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And we found out that Purdue University Northwest is working with another amount to help students at the universities, campuses in Hammond and Westville. With us to talk about it, we have Yolanda Mosley. She's the Vice Chancellor of Enrollment Management and Student Affairs at Purdue University Northwest. And thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
It's my pleasure to be a part of the program.
Will you fill us in on some of the efforts that have prompted Purdue University Northwest to have this money available from the federal government, and what indirectly is going to help students?
Definitely. So as we all know, we've all been struggling with the pandemic, and it's had a lot of impact on our students specifically. We have a very diverse range of students that attend PNW, and so about 70% of our students are receiving some type of federal or scholarship assistance to help them be able to be college-bound. And we know that what the pandemic has done is that it's really squeezed our students really tight to have to be how they prioritize their education with everything else that is happening that's impacting them economically, emotionally, and the financial impact on that. And the government has recognized that as well. And we know that being able to make sure that our students are college bound is a great way to make sure that there's social mobility. And so the CARES Act funds, which they've been come to be known as, are really helping students be able to put their higher education top at the list, and make sure that they can pay for tuition, make sure that they can buy their books, but also making sure that they can meet their daily needs of housing, providing for childcare, going grocery shopping, just those day-to-day things that are now even becoming more essential for them to be successful in college. And so we've been able to take a significant amount of our funds and direct them to students to make sure that they can continue their education at PNW. We have about $3.8 million right now that are designated. We opened up our application on Friday evening for students. Within 72 hours, we had about 2,500 students that already notified us that they were interested in getting their funds, and we have like another 1,000 students that are submitting applications to get funds. And so students can get anywhere from $600 to $1,200 directly, and then they can apply for additional funds in the amount up to $3,000 mm-hmm. to be able to help with some of those expenses that we know that they're having.
I understand this is the second time in about a year that Purdue University Northwest has been able to distribute the federal funds to the students that had these financial issues. Will you tell us about the first distribution, how it went, and how it seems to have helped students, at least at the time, get by?
Yep, we gave out about $6 million last fall semester. And all that went directly to students, and the impact was significant. Of those students that we gave funds to, 13% of those students graduated, and another 77% of our students who received assistance were able to continue their education into the spring semester. So we know that the funds are impactful, and we know that the funds support them. And once again, we're a very student-centered campus. We know that students are why we're here, and that commitment is what really propels us to make sure that these funds are going into the hands of our students directly. We want to make sure that there's no impediment that prevents them from either one, being college bound, or two, being able to complete their degree at PNW. And so we've had an application process last semester, and we have another one this semester, but there's much more leeway with what students can do with their funds this spring semester, and that's based off of just some of the changes to the federal government's procedures and policies. But last semester, we were able to help a lot of students make sure that they could stay in college and stay on campus in the fall and into the spring.
Did Purdue Northwest have any other campaigns, ways to help bring money together from the community as well as from these other sources to help students? And did scholarships fit into that as well, too?
They definitely did. So we have an amazing advancement office that is out there connecting with our community, making sure that they know all the amazing things that we do and how they can support our students. And also, just institutional funds are helping to support our students with scholarships. So this year, we're able to extend our offering of scholarships for our incoming students. Typically, we would close that December 1, This year, we're extending that until any student who can apply by May 1st, we are able to offer them one of our academic merit scholarships. And so that's $2,000 that can help students finance their education at PNW. And so that commitment came from our deans. And so we're committed as an institution to really kind of put our miles where our energies and efforts are to make sure that we're supporting our students. But we also know that as much as we can do as a community, this that saying, it takes a village. So as much as that we can do as a community to support our students, we know that the outcomes just benefit the region overall.
Were there any kind of community organizations as well as even perhaps even business and industry that have chipped in to help find ways to keep the funds coming in?
Definitely there have been. And our advancement office has those relationships that connect our students with those opportunities, that there's grants and there's different funds that organizations are providing and supporting our students with.
I understand that Purdue Northwest had, I guess, some nearly $9 million in emergency funding that they've handed over to help students out. And I guess the universities do have to follow some federal guidelines for the money, and that Purdue Northwest actually went above and beyond what the feds tell you that you have to do.
Right. And what we were doing is, once again, is like our focus is right there on the students. And so we had funds that were designated just for students, but then there's institutional funds that are also bestowed to the institutions that are federal funds for those CARES Act dollars. And so we took not just our student funds, but also the funds that were earmarked for the institution and put those right in the hands of our students. And so we were one of the first campuses last fall to get that money in the hands of our students. We have as I said earlier, a population that really needs that financial commitment from the institution, but also from the government. And as a state, we're also recognizing that importance. Just recently, I think even just today, the Indiana Commission for Higher Ed has extended that April 15th deadline for the FAFSA. And so that's the federal student aid program that students are able to complete to be able to get significant funds to help them finish their education. And so that's been extended. And we're connecting with our students to make sure that they're aware of those opportunities that don't just exist on campus, but also those federal programs from the CARES Act, but also from those FAFSA funds that they can be eligible for.
I know you mentioned at the start of our conversation about the efforts that students can go to online to get to the Purdue Northwest website to find out more information. Will you give us the address again and what in particular they should ask for when they go online to look into this information, in particular the special help?
Yep. So the web address is pnw.edu/HERRF. That's pnw.edu/HERRF. And on the application, it allows the student to put their name and their contact information. And we ask that students make sure that they understand that these are funds that need to be earmarked that are demonstrating that they've been impacted by the pandemic. So is it because of the pandemic that you're having financial issues in terms of employment or in terms of meeting your housing needs, in terms of meeting your tuition? It all has to be directly related to the pandemic. And then as students are applying for those funds, we're getting those funds into the hands of the students. So our students who completed their applications over Friday and over the weekend and Monday, we're getting those monies in the hands of students today.
That's great to hear.
And We're making sure that we're being expedient to make sure that we meet their needs right away.
Have you gotten any feedback, any comments yet from students, from family members about the efforts that's come through, and especially with this latest round of help?
We haven't heard anything from the latest round, but I can tell you that from the round that we did last semester, we actually received emails from students thanking us that the impact that those funds had on them being able to complete their education and stay in school was invaluable to them. And it's nice when you hear from students some appreciation, but also at the same time, we're committed to doing this. And so we wouldn't have done it any other way than to make sure that we were getting the money in the hands of our students. But our students are extremely appreciative. Even before we launched this round of money, we were having students contacting us asking when are the funds going to be available. They want to make sure that they knew what they could do to make sure that they could meet their needs. And so, one, the need is out there, and two, we want to make sure that we're as prompt as possible to address it and that we're alleviating any barriers to them getting that money as soon as possible. So our application is very much set up to make sure that there's not too many back and forth interactions that we're having with the students, that they complete the application. There's an authorization that's embedded in the application so that they don't have to do the application and then have a follow-up with us. But everything is happening all at once, and then, as I said, we're getting that money in the hands of students as early as today.
Once again, the web address to go to if you want to find out more about this is the Purdue Northwest address, which is pnw.edu/giving. And you can also select, I guess, the Dean of Students Emergency Fund for more information. And Yolanda, thank you very much for filling us in on the great information. The best of luck in the next distribution of the federal funds that will help students from both the Hammond and the Westville campuses that need the help.
Thanks a lot for having us be able to share this information.
Well, you're welcome. Yolanda Mosley is the Vice Chancellor for Enrollment Management and Student Affairs at Purdue University Northwest. As more and more Americans get vaccinated for COVID-19, some states are beginning to lift restrictions on gatherings. But for some people, the thought of going back to a pre-pandemic lifestyle is cause for anxiety. We find out more about that in this from Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson.
Miranda Tetzloff is a 25-year-old who has two pit bull mixes named Bub and Goose. She takes them on long walks for exercise, but she recently caught herself backing out of a hike because she was afraid of seeing other people on the trail.
Oh, it's nice outside. We've been in a pandemic and everyone's been cooped up in their homes. Oh, that means everyone's going to probably also be at the park. And so that just kind of terrifies me.
Tetzloff, a childcare worker, lives in a suburb of Indianapolis. There are still about 1,000 new COVID cases a day in the state, but the governor recently lifted the statewide mask mandate and ended restrictions on businesses. Daily life is slowly starting to resemble pre-pandemic times, and Tetzloff says that worries her.
I don't know what the next person's doing with their life. I don't know if they just got off a plane. I don't know, you know, what they're doing and how they're keeping themselves safe.
Tetzloff has been vaccinated, but is still overwhelmed when she notices people not wearing a mask or not taking social distancing as seriously as before.
It's just anxiety. I feel like that's like what I feel when I think about having to go to the park or like see other people.
Kevin Rand says feeling anxious about going back to pre-COVID activities is normal. He's a psychology professor at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis.
So given that many of us have been sort of, you know, staying at home or not doing the things we typically do for the last year, as we start to reengage in those activities, they're going to seem new and a little bit anxiety provoking.
He says these feelings are similar to the anxiety felt before the first day of school and are likely to pass soon.
Because we're going back to something we've done before, that predicts it'll be a pretty quick recovery to feeling normal again.
Rand says some people might experience anxiety for longer. If feelings extend for a few weeks, he recommends seeking professional help. And he says people will have legitimate concerns about their health.
There is still a pandemic going on, so even though, you know, we're making good progress with vaccinations and things like that, there is a health stressor out there.
That's the sort of thing that concerns Misty Asbury, an office worker for a utility company in Indianapolis. She's worked from home since the pandemic started and is hesitant to go back to the office.
I'm very concerned about going back into a workplace and working just because it is an office where you're in cubicles, so you're not enclosed in your own workspace per se. We have one break room for essentially 80 people.
Asbury worries about not being able to assess the cleanliness of the office. She says she is fully vaccinated, but is still erring on the side of caution, limiting public outings and declining family gatherings.
I think people need to do a personal risk assessment.
That's Thomas Dzinski, an epidemiologist with the Indiana University Fairbanks School of Public Health. He says it's important for people to look at what they and others are doing to reduce the chance of catching the virus, especially as it mutates and continues to infect people.
So it's assessing how much risk an individual has. And then I think there's also the social responsibility that we all have a certain social obligation to help each other out.
Like getting vaccinated, wearing masks, and continuing to social distance. Asbury doesn't feel comfortable quite yet in going back into the world.
I'm anxious in a happy way to be around people, but I kind of think I want it on my own terms to be able to do that.
She'll finally feel safe when COVID cases and the positivity rate fall, and when everyone is fully vaccinated. From Side Effects Public Media, I'm Darian Benson.
NIPSCO is moving forward with its renewable energy initiative that's called Your Energy, Your Future, bringing lower cost and cleaner and sustainable energy to its customers today and in the future. The lead engineer on the renewables team, Andy Campbell, and NIPSCO spokesperson Tara McElmurray was with us some time ago to talk about this initiative and about the first two wind energy farms that are actually now online.
Our Your Energy, Your Future generation transition plan started back in 2018 when we were going through our integrated resource planning process, which is something we do every couple years. One thing that we did different in 2018 was we conducted a request for proposal process in which we analyzed hundreds of proposals, checking to see what would be, the best source of generating energy for our customers going forward. And we found, which was actually quite a surprise to us with the technology advancements, that renewable resources such as wind, solar, and battery technology were actually most cost-effective for our customers. As a result of that, of moving forward with those technologies, we are going to be retiring both of our remaining coal plants. Our Schahfer Generating Station, which is in Wheatfield, Indiana, will be retired in 2023. And then our Michigan City Generating Station in Michigan City, Indiana, is planned to be retired in 2028. So we will be 100% coal-free by 2028. In its place, we will be replacing that generation with, as I said, a mix of wind, solar, and battery technology, which will be joining our Sugar Creek Generating Station, which is our natural gas plant down in Terre Haute, mm-hmm. along with our hydroelectric generation, which is in Monticello, Indiana. And with all of that, we will be saving our customers more than $4 billion over the long term.
Andy, if you will, from the renewable assets team side, what did you all discover in talking with the contractors and getting the first two projects, certainly, that are now online, the Rosewater Wind and the Jordan Creek Wind plants online? What have you learned that is going to be the future of NIPSCO with these projects and many more that are coming up?
Obviously, we are resolute in running our request for proposals to really find the best projects. NIPSCO is not, quote-unquote, in the development business. So we want to leave the building of these assets to the, quote-unquote, professionals who do it every day, right? And the two wind farms that came online recently are consistent with kind of our short-term action plan to bring on some wind to gain some additional experience. The first one is in Jordan Creek in Benton Warren County, Indiana, 400 megawatts, and that's a purchase power agreement with our partners at NextEra Energy Resources. And a purchase power agreement is basically an agreement where NextEra will continue to own and operate the facility, and NIPSCO is agreeing to buy the power from there. Rosewater with a partner, EDP Renewables, is a joint venture asset, which is basically a different term for a NIPSCO project that NIPSCO will own. That project, in addition, will operate, and NIPSCO will have full responsibility for that project and is a part of its overall fleet. So with those projects, they were kind of the first offing of both of those structures for us, pursuant to the integrated resource plan that Tara mentioned. And then obviously we've had a number of announcements related to solar and other wind farm and battery storage that we expect to come online between now and 2023.
Tell us a little bit about the ones that folks here in Northwest Indiana are likely to see as far as the solar panels are concerned. I know there are some projects that are going to be planned for a place like in Jasper County in particular and some other counties in Indiana as well. Tell us about those.
We've announced bill transfer agreements, joint venture structures with NextEra Energy Resources. There's going to be two projects in Jasper County, right around 700 megawatts of solar installation and then 75 megawatt battery as well. In addition, in White County, there'll be a 200 megawatt facility that has a 60 megawatt hour battery in addition. So those are all really well located in NIPSCO service territory. And, the technology in general is kind of advanced to the point where we feel it's an adequate replacement for the coal facilities. And, as far as locationally, you know, we don't necessarily, you know, tell these developers where to put these projects. The nature of the agreement is we either buy the power from the facility or we agree to buy the project when it's complete. And the development is really left to the professionals. And with wind and solar, it's important to have a lot of geographic diversity so that if the sun's maybe not shining in one spot, it's perhaps shining in another, or you know, the wind is maybe diminished here and higher there. So having a mix of projects spread throughout our service territory as well as even other parts of the state can provide a value of diversity there to, you know, kind of protect that energy flow.
Do you think that's going to be the best advantage that NIPSCO has, is that if you have a day where maybe you have lots of sunshine here in the northwest corner of the state, but not so much in other places, and vice versa, that maybe it's cloudy here in Lake County, say, but it's not cloudy in Henry County over in the eastern side of the state, that you're going to have the advantage of shifting the power around?
So shifting the power around is key, but also what's key is NIPSCO itself is kind of what's part of a broader integrated market energy market that really covers all of Indiana and, in fact, really the whole central part of the United States. So we have access. We essentially sell the power that we create to that market, and we buy what we need. And that occurs with all other utilities that are a member of this market. So it really provides diversity and location that NIPSCO customers gain advantages of, from everything down to the Louisiana coast all the way up to the Canadian border across the central part of the U.S. So while we have projects that we anticipate will be spread throughout the state of Indiana and even one more so announced in the northern part of Kentucky, we actually take value in our energy needs from the broader integrated market as well.
Well, Tara, it sounds like from NIPSCO's standpoint, it's going to be a very exciting years ahead as the initiative gets going and bring these opportunities in to bring more renewable energy into the picture here in the region.
Absolutely. We're super excited for, you know, all of our what's already been announced and what's to come here in 2021. Definitely excited to be, you know, making the state of Indiana more attractive to employers and residents, and definitely excited to begin saving our customers' money.
That's Tara Mackel-Murray along with Andy Campbell with NIPSCO. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Wellcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Wellcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
In my neighborhood in Glen Park, nobody had any money. There really were no professionals. This wasn't doctor, lawyer, that kind of a neighborhood. These guys were steel workers and et cetera. A typical day for me was a lot of chaos. This is a two-bedroom house, one bathroom. So you could picture five kids and two adults. You can imagine we didn't live very well. It was loud. It was dirty. It was messy. You know, I had just about the greatest friend that a guy could have. This guy knew how I lived. He could never come over to my house. It was just, I would be too embarrassed to have anybody in my house. As much as I could get away from my house, I did. Didn't mean I didn't love my brothers and sisters and my parents. Just couldn't stand the dirt and the noise. You know, growing up, race was never discussed around me. Nobody in the block would ever talk about this. That's what's so strange about Gary. There were no signs, whites only, blacks only, but it was like there was an iron curtain there that you just didn't penetrate. But in 1968, a Valpo law graduate named Richard Hatcher, a black man, got elected mayor of Gary. And I'll tell you exactly what happened, because it happened on my block, and it happened on every block in Glen Park. Almost immediately after this guy got elected, for sale signs up, there was this huge flood of people that left to flee to Portage, Valparaiso, Merrillville. People were concerned property values would go down. And there was a great fear that pent-up resentment from black people was going to spill forth in terms of violence against whites. What was 100% white area, I would say it was 75% black. My street turned into just a ghetto. I went down there a couple years ago. It's scary. Any house that isn't boarded up are just a mess. They need paint. There's debris in the yard. You might see a car in a front yard all rusted out. Truthfully, I wouldn't get out of my car in my block now. It just looks rough, like something could happen. But in 1968, we moved to Miller Beach. Lily White, Miller Beach. My street now, where I used to live there in Miller, it's 90% black. However, that house in Miller Beach looks better now than when we lived in it. So it isn't necessarily true that if black people move in, they will destroy. Didn't happen in our Miller neighborhood. Why it happened in Glen Park, I don't know. I'm guilty of not taking a very active role in change, but listen to the way this situation was handled in Gary, Northwest Indiana. Everything would have been fine in Gary if people would have just calmed down. He got elected and it was like, we don't want to talk, we just want to run. As you get older, then you have the luxury to go back and reflect on, why didn't I get active in civil rights in Gary, Indiana? I mean, I didn't even think or care about the Vietnam War. I didn't care about black people. I didn't care about anybody except my own survival, because that's a way I had to think about it. And so, you know, you have regrets about that because you have very strong feelings about these things now. But when you're going through things the way I went through them, you just have to bury it. You have to keep on going.
You can find more original stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.